Today on Rambling About Cars, are tires the most taken for granted item on your car? Quite possibly so, and we have the world's premier expert on tires with us to tell you all about that sort of thing, along with some new Michelin Pilot Sport 5 news. We're going to have a lot of tire talk. There's also the little thing going on. What's it called? Oh, yeah, the New York International Auto Show. We're going to talk about a few debuts there. Possibly, if there's time, a Toyota GR Corolla conspiracy theory. Without further ado, it's podcast time. I'm Christopher Smith, and let me toss it over to Mr. Chris Bruce.
Hi, everybody. And our guest tonight is Jonathan Benson. And if you have been a super long time listener to Rambling About Cars, you will recognize him. He was on episode 7 of the show. So that means we have not seen him for roughly like 59 weeks. So, Jonathan, welcome. Thank you for coming back.
Welcome.
What's been going on in the last year and change?
Oh, thank you for having me back. I'm always surprised when I get invited back, especially as tires are not perhaps the most interesting of subject matters. Last year has been quite interesting. I'm now a resident of the USA. Resident. I got my green card and I've moved to Salt Lake City, Utah. So I'm now continuing what I was doing in Europe and trying to expand what I'm doing in the US. So I've got some quite exciting plans, including like an all-terrain tire test coming up, which I'll be testing in Texas about a month and a half.
That was one of my questions I was going to ask you later. We'll touch base on
that. Yeah, we'll get back to that. But it's been really, really good 12 months or 57 weeks, as we said. It's nice to see your faces again.
Yeah, it was nice good to see you. And Salt Lake City.
Pretty cool car, as I understand. Don't you own a 6 Series now, a first-gen 6 Series?
Yeah, that was one of the things. I moved to the US and I was missing home and family and friends. And obviously, I've left my cars back in the UK because importing them is difficult. Oh, and yeah. I was on Cars and Bids, and it just so happened a 635 CSI manual came up for sale in Wyoming near Christmas. And I had an automatic one back in the day, the E24. Cool. And I always wanted another one, and I always wanted a manual because the 5-speed's so much better than the 3-speed with overdrive. Mm-hmm. And I bid on it up until about $9,500, and I didn't win it. I disappeared, and then I came back, and I was because the other person I was bidding with, there was only two of us, and he got it for still less than $10,000. Admittedly, it's high at 170,000 miles, but mint condition inside, mechanically absolutely sound. Paint needs a bit of work. And so I was kicking myself. And about a week later, I got an email from Collecting Cars and Bids the top bidder has like disappeared. He's ghosted them. Would you still like it for your highest bid? And I was like, absolutely yes. So I did a road trip over New Year to Wyoming to Casper. Yep, that's the car.
Well, it's not your car. That's a press photo from the 80s.
Mine's actually in that color. I've got different wheels.
Oh, cool. And
not the German looking plates. So did a trip over to Casper in Wyoming, which is about 8 hours over New Year's. Picked it up. Obviously, it's got Continental Extreme Contact Sport summer tires on, brand new. So fair play for the previous owner for fitting them. But yeah, it was snowing and blizzarding, and I was in Walmart buying snow chains, or like, do I go and put some like all season or winter tires on to get me home? But I found a little hole in the weather on the second, and I drove it back in one hit, 7.5-8 hours, didn't miss a beat. Nice. Yeah, really happy with it. But since then, it's been parked up in the garage and I've not touched it. So I've got a restaurant in Utah this week. I've not been in Europe. I've not been in the US. So,
okay.
Well, I'm sure listeners are aware that this is my favorite BMW of all time. So, and I'm in Rapid City. That's not that far away from Salt Lake City. If you need anybody to just come check out the car, drive it a little bit, a lot. If you decide you're gonna, I don't know, maybe sell it. I could be your guy.
He hasn't even driven it yet. He's not selling it. Come on, man.
I'd like to keep it. It's a childhood dream. I would say it's my favorite BMW, but the 507 exists, which is that's to me, that's god tier BMW. But the 635 is a close second.
That's a nice
635 is much more accessible though. Like yes, you can a 507. Well, that's like
they're going up in value though. I mean it's not 507, but those E24s.
Well, in Europe
they're starting to go up in a hurry.
I've got a friend who actually works for Continental, and he's into his classic cars in Germany. And I was chatting to him about it, and he was like, "Dude, this would be like €20,000 car in Germany, easily." easily. So like the US is starting to appreciate them a lot more. I see the same with some of like the not the E36 M3, but maybe just like the E36, like the 328s or the lower spec ones. They're still quite cheap here. And I know where I'm from, they're definitely not cheap anymore. So I've always got my eye out for a good E30 or an E36.
I can't wait to get your hot take on the BMW X7 facelift that debuted like an hour ago. That'll be a surprise later on.
Let's continue the tire talk. So yes. Michelin just came out and you have a video of it. I'll be putting it up here in just a second in our screen. But Michelin just came out with the new Pilot Sport 5. Mm-hmm. I was trying to look online to figure out when the Pilot Sport name came out. The best I could see was late 90s-ish, maybe. I was seeing like 97, 98. That might be incorrect. But regardless, it's not every day that they come out with a new iteration of the Pilot Sport. So it's kind of a big deal. And that's kind of a big name in sporting tires. And you guys did, or tire reviews, your YouTube channel and website, you put them on a Volkswagen GTI against a bunch of other tires, some from brands I'd never heard of. Giti and Semperit.
Yeah.
Never heard of those brands, but and you kind of tested them. So
and that's kind of a big deal because, I mean, I haven't seen anybody else yet have that comprehensive of a test on the Pilot Sport 5. Yeah. Never mind putting it up against so many other tires. I mean, just give us a little bit of an overview on the test, because that's a big deal.
I think to start with, the Pilot Sport 5 doesn't replace the Pilot Sport 4S, which is the tire the American market's a lot more used to. The Pilot Sport 4 is the predecessor to the Pilot Sport 5. Now, US did get some sizes of the Pilot Sport 4, but not as many as Europe gets, because Europe, the Pilot Sport 4S starts at 19 inch and there's a couple of 18 inch sizes, whereas you get a 4S all the way down to 16 inch. So the 4S is the more sporty ultra high performance tire, whereas the 4 was always slightly more, there's not a huge amount in it, but it was more always more the slightly more comfort biased tire. So the Pilot Sport 5 again fits in that niche, in that it's that category, that it's for people with the Pilot Sport 4S, especially in the larger sizes, it probably isn't a natural replacement or a like-for-like replacement or a like-for-like upgrade, because it is designed with a little bit more comfort, a little bit better rolling resistance, all those things you want from maybe a bigger, sportier family car rather than an outright performance tire. However, it is a very, very, very sexy tire, because Michelin have gone full on soft velvet on the sidewall. And if you've got a picture of it, there's a good.
I saw you showing it off at the end.
The end. If you can find
get
that
to there,
as a sidewall design goes, it's fantastic.
I've never heard somebody refer to a tire like that. I think it's fantastic. It's like, it does looks cool. I mean, it's a thin sidewall, it's performance tire, but it just looks cool, right?
And it's just this, even to touch it, I think I cut it out of the final video, but just to touch it, it just feels soft and silky. And it is a lovely thing. I mean, look at that. That on the side of your car is just, it is porn, isn't it?
It kind of is. I haven't really thought about it that way before, but you are the world's premier expert on tires.
It's sidewalls are subjective, but I think a lot of people are really liking this. So what the Pilot Sport 5 brought over the Pilot Sport 4, it wasn't a huge increase in dry grip or wet grip or anything like that. It was a huge increase in wear specifically. So Michelin are always trying to be the leaders in longevity, so you get the best wear out of the tire with the lowest amount of tread wear. I think the Pilot Sport 4 fell a bit short of expectations in the market, because it was often beaten by the Continental. The equivalent would be Premium Contact 6 and the Goodyear Eagle F1 Asymmetric 5. It always lagged behind those two a little bit. So what Michelin have done is they've essentially kept everything the Pilot Sport 4 had, which was a very, very good tire, and added about 40% more wear, which, if you know anything about tires, adding that much wear performance or tread life performance without reducing wet grip or rolling resistance or dry grip or anything like that, that's hugely impressive. Yeah. So when I was testing in this test, I'd already tested the asymmetric 6 against the 5, and the 5 The 5 was a very good tire. So I said the 5 and the asymmetric 5 and the Pilot Sport 4 were equal. They were good rivals. And knowing what I knew about the Pilot Sport 5 and the asymmetric 6, I actually expected the asymmetric 6 to win the test overall, because the asymmetric 6 moved on the performance of the asymmetric 5. And technically, because we weren't testing wear, the Pilot Sport 5 didn't. But what we actually found was that the both products were very comparable. Both products were absolutely fantastic. They are very different feeling tires, and I know you don't get the asymmetric range in the US. I think of it a bit like a slightly softer Supercar 3. So the Pilot Sport 5 is intended for that kind of more rounded, like all-encompassing ability. So it's not an all-out performance, sharp handling tire, but it does deliver buckets of grip. It's always a very safe, commutative, understeer, balanced tire. It is a great tire. Like you say, Michelin, online especially, there's, if you go onto any forums, performance tires or UHP tires are Michelin for a lot of the internet. So for a tire like this to come out, it has caused a little bit of confusion between Europe and the US, because obviously I don't think you're getting a huge amount of sizes. There's certainly not a lot of sizes in at the moment. That might change with time. And I think what everyone's going to be really excited about is the replacement for the 4S. When that eventually arrives. It is a great tire. It's a very good looking tire. And I hope, if nothing else, it inspires some other tire manufacturers to up their sidewall game, because the asymmetric 6 might be an equal on paper, and it might have the edge in terms of the handling and sportiness, which I personally prefer. But to look at, it's nothing compared to any Michelin. So
if I could, let me just ask a little bit about the testing procedure, because I mean, you're talking about wet grip, dry grip, tire wear. How have you kind of fine-tuned your procedures over the years? Because honestly, I don't think I've really encountered anybody that gets as comprehensive as you do on these kinds of tests. I mean, you're evaluating so many different metrics. Is that something that you were doing from the beginning, or is that something that evolved over time? And how long does this process take?
And wait, real quick, let me just piggyback on that, because I had kind of a similar question. Also, how do you end up defining the best? Because you were talking about the difference between the Goodyear and the Michelin. They both, you kind of tied them in one place, but the Michelin, the wear rating is better, that, you know, that could give someone X number, 1,000 miles more with that performance. Do you balance that when you kind of consider what's best, or is it just purely what's best in terms of handling, et cetera?
I will try and answer both questions. Forgive me if I forget something. Regarding like how we test, luckily in Europe, there's more serious independent tire testing in Europe. So there's a kind of, there's already a methodology of how you're doing it. And that's piggybacked off what the tire companies do internally. Okay. So when I started, I worked alongside a number of tire companies closely to kind of like define what a good tire test should be and what they think a tire test should be and what I think the public want to see, because there's differences for sure. And initially it was, I would say, quite a basic test. And over time, things have evolved. But the basics are always there: dry handling, dry braking, wet handling, wet braking, noise, rolling resistance, comfort. A lot of that's objective. So braking, wet braking is one of the key performance criteria. You can't really get that wrong in terms of, or you can't really do many things with it. You can absolutely get it wrong. It's surprisingly complicated to do wet braking. But there's only one measure, and that's braking distance. So that's fairly set. Over time, I've definitely sort of refined some of the more subjective, and I'm trying to improve all the time. So I'm constantly, whenever I have the opportunity to speak to other tire testers from Europe or internal and companies, I'm always asking for suggestions and ideas and ways I can improve. So one of the things I'm working towards now is getting a little bit more emphasis on subjectiveness. And I've always found the difficulty with subjective ratings is, by the very nature, they're subjective. So what I like, someone else might not like. So I've never scored them particularly high overall in the weighting, but luckily with the medium of YouTube and video, you can talk about it a lot more. So if someone's not just looking at a data set, someone's watching a video, and I'm trying to explain everything about that, and you kind of, over time, you realize that or I've realized what I like in a tire, which is a really pointy, fighty, like almost like a tire that almost wants to kill you. It's exciting. That's what I personally like. That's what I want. That's what I like in a tire, because it's a challenge. It's exciting. But that shouldn't be a super high rating for that kind of behavior, because on the road, that's the absolute last thing you want.
I don't see anybody going into, you know, discount tire and seeing a marketing slogan. These are the tires that could kill you.
Yeah, exactly. So
I want that.
So in terms of tires like the Pilot Sport 5, which perhaps aren't quite as dynamically as exciting as I would pick, I've come to realize actually that's a tire that's very good for most people. So that certainly evolved. As for the question about wear, because I don't test the wear in the tests, and I'll tell you why in a second, I can't, even though if I might have seen in other tests that tire A does better than tire B in terms of wear, because I'm not testing it and it's not part of my data set, I can't grade on that data set. So I can't include that overall. If there's something extreme, like a tire that's fallen apart after a few laps of dry handling, then it gets mentioned. But generally, dry handling doesn't really correlate with road wear. Wear is something that is super important, especially for the American market. And it's something I'm working on constantly. But the issue with wear, I can't remember if we went into this last time, is it's incredibly expensive. So so I had 9 sets of tires in that test. And to do an accurate wear test would have been over $100,000. Because what you need essentially 9 cars, probably 11 actually, because you need control tires as well. And then you literally have drivers that drive them in convoy for 15,000 kilometers. And at every half day, drivers get rotated, cars get rotated, wheels get rotated between cars, positions of cars in the convoy get rotated. So there's all these controls, but to drive 15,000 miles on 9 sets of tires it's just time, man. So you're paying people on petrol and everything like that. So wear is something I'm fascinated by. At the moment, I haven't had the opportunity to really include it. It's something I'm trying to do more of in the future, and I'm always looking for ways. And I guess that's where user reviews on sites like Tire Reviews or Tire Rack are really useful, because that gives real world, because we can put them on drums and run them on drums. And some tire companies do believe that a drum is semi-accurate to a road, but that's the minority. Like a lot of companies, and they all have the same drum machines, a lot of companies say that it doesn't correlate in the real world. So the data you get off a drum is almost useless. Mm-hmm. So if it's useless, why include it?
Right. And I feel like this is a conversation that we touched on the previous tire podcast, because I mean, you're right. In the United States, you walk into any tire store and you're just blasted with 50,000 mile tread wear, 70,000 mile tread wear. And I mean, for years, I mean, that was sort of my metric. It's like, yeah, I want a sporty tire, but what's something that's going to last? And over time, and I can't believe that this didn't just smack me in the head sooner, it's like, I would much rather have my tires, I don't know, grip and like stop and turn, as opposed to lasting probably way longer than I'm going to have this car. Yeah. And I can't help but think that a lot of people, and maybe even a lot of people listening, think in that manner too. Why should a high performance test matter to me? Well, the one time where you might be pushing your car to the limits, maybe in an emergency situation, you're going to damn well want to know that my tires are going to be able to grip and stop a little bit better than the competition. And I think that's something that these performance tests that you're putting out, I mean, it's critical, because, yeah, you know what? I'm not going to be tracking my car all the time. But if I need to do an emergency lane change, if I need to do an emergency stop, that one time, if that saves the car or it saves a life, that matters, right?
Tires are cheaper than most of your excess or copays or whatever you call it for insurance. Mm-hmm. I get the comment fairly often on YouTube. It's like, who slides their car around a track on the way to the store? I'm like, okay, that is a fair point. But also by discovering that, we're discovering the ultimate lateral grip of the tire. We're discovering the balance and how the tire reacts in extreme situations. So when a moose jumps out of you and you're doing a rapid lane change, you're going to know that you can rely on this tire. And likewise, wet braking is where, like in-town wet braking is where most accidents happen, according to the statistics. So a tire that saves you a couple of meters in wet braking is good. And the difference between a cheap tire, I've just been writing up a test by a German publication called Auto Build, and the difference between a premium tire, the best wet braking tire, and the budget tire was something like 36 meters, admittedly a low mean surface, which is, I mean, they're a little bit cheeky actually, because they actually measure from 80 to 5 and then they calculate it from 100 to 0 kilometers an hour. So the figures are slightly extended, but I'm sure their calculation method is correct. But that's the difference between stopping safely or still be doing sort of 30, 40 miles an hour when you hit the thing.
Well, I tell you, since I started watching your reviews here a couple years ago, it's totally changed my perspective, because I was the type where I would go into the tire store. Okay, I could be kind of aggressive sometimes with my cars. Just give me the cheapest thing, because I'm just going to burn them off anyways, right? What's just give me your cheap performance tire. And I'm sad to say I have that on the Mustang now, and that's going to be changing here in a little bit. I'm hardly driving it now. That's going to be changing in a little bit, just because, I mean, I've seen your test, like especially the test that you just did, where you have a few of the cheaper brands in with these name brands, and seeing the difference in performance. It's like, I think the average person thinks, well, it's a tire, right? You'll have different design and tread, but it's all rubber, right? But it's not. I mean, can you tell us a little bit about the differences you've seen with the less expensive brands versus the name brands?
Yeah, I mean, the data speaks for itself when you're talking 50% difference in wet braking. Wet handling is, to be fair to the cheaper tires I've tested recently, that they're not as bad as they once were. But I've definitely driven tires. The tire genuinely feels like it's trying to kill you, and not in a fun, controllable way. Because there is, I think a lot of people think, okay, low grip tires, at least I can practice drifting, or on a wet roundabout or a wet, windy road, I can practice getting the back out. But generally with these low quality tires, it's not only a lack of grip, it's a lack of like feedback and response from the tire. So you think you'll be able to go out and drifting, but the first time you drift, you'll be spinning into a ditch probably, because the tire's giving you no information about the limit of grip. And then when it's passed, like the progressiveness or the grip drop off, the grip curve is, instead of being nice at peak and then a nice gradual fall off, which good tires generally are, it's a kind of a peak and then it just drops off a cliff. So at that point, you can't even recover it. And I've thought, when I started this, I was like, at least cheap tires, I can go around wet handling and have fun. It's more often than not, the more expensive tires, the higher grip tires, are more fun on wet handling, because you've got more control over what you're doing. And it's a lot of the time, it can be a false economy as well. Not just because you might crash and have to pay your copay on your insurance, because they don't last as long. Generally, the premium manufacturers, they all do spend a lot of, not just Michelin, Continental, Goodyear, all the Pirelli, Bridgestone, all the premium manufacturers, Hankook, they all focus on the whole picture. So they're not trying to get a tire that works well in one category. Or in the EU, we have these label scores. You have wet grip, noise and rolling resistance scored like a utility. Mm-hmm. And now it's got to the point where a budget tire manufacturer can get a respectable EU label score. So it'll be C in wet grip, A in rolling resistance, and a moderate noise score. But all they've done is sacrificed completely in another area. So now you've got a tire that looks good on paper, but actually it's going to last you 8,000 miles, when a tire that costs twice as much will actually last sort of six times as long. And then the performance, the third aspect of it, is another thing Michelin push very hard. And I've started doing some testing with this year. It's worn state performance as well, because I actually did a test. It's not out yet, and I'm not sure when it'll be out, probably later this year. Okay. I've done an all-season, all-weather test already with Michelin this year against competitors. And part of that was worn state testing. And I tested a worn Michelin Cross Climate 2. So a tire available in the US market, everyone knows and loves the Cross Climate 2. This was worn state. So it was buffed down to nearly the legal limit of 1.6 millimeters. I'm not sure what that was. And it's still outperformed a reasonable budget tire in the snow.
Really?
Which is just, incredible. Yeah, and I honestly I was, the first time I drove that, I had to get out of the car after the first lap and check they put the right Michelins on. I was like, this has to be the new tire. It was a different day from testing the new tire, so conditions can affect things quite a lot. But I was like, okay, this is only like 4 or 5 seconds a lap slower around a 2 minute lap. How, this has to be a new tire still. And I got out and there was pretty much no tread depth. So
wow,
like, yeah, that's really impressive. So there's lots of aspects to a good quality tire. And it's not just what you see on a sticker or what the tread mileage warranty tells you or what your mate down the pub says. Is there is a lot to a tire.
So, Jonathan, last question about tires before we move on to our other topic for tonight. But I've got one. You can feel free to judge me, but I think it might end up being all of us on this, including you.
Yeah.
So you did a video, and this was a video that was actually suggested to me recently because I do watch your stuff. But you did a video. This is why you should fit OE, original equipment tires, to your car. Mm-hmm. And all three of us now, I guess with you, with your BMW 6 Series, obviously Smith with his Mustang, and I have a 2006 Mini Cooper. They don't make my original equipment tires anymore. My car came with Pirellis. I never really liked them, so I switched to something different the first time. But OE tires are not an option for me, and I would put money down whatever was on your 6 Series. They don't make anymore either.
Yeah.
So what do you do? Like, I mean, you own an older car, an older fun car. How do you pick a tire for that?
The video you put on screen, I think, was a very good video.
I'm not judging. Realize. It's just that there are situations where the OE doesn't exist anymore.
Oh, yeah. It's not just the OE doesn't exist. The OE isn't the best tire anymore. So that M3 tire is quite... On a day-to-day, what I didn't do in the video was explain that actually case by case, this has to be analyzed because that M3 is a very, very specific tire. It's a new car, new tire, like everything's new about it. So that's great and fine for that car and that setup. Absolutely fit the Pilot Sport 4S bit star mark, the one developed for the car. Cause it's night and day different to the aftermarket tire. It really is. It should have a different name. However, in all of our scenarios, OE tires, I think, By signing the OE agreement, it's either 10 or 15 years they sign up to be producing that tire. And over 10, to say it's 10 years, over 10 years, you're probably going to see two or three iterations of a tire model. So the tire that was made for that car 10 years ago, they're still producing it in exactly the same specification and compound. They've not rolled in any compound updates because they're not allowed to. So generally, I would say probably, like this is a figure that is trying to generalize something that's very complicated. But I say generally, once you get to 4 or 5 years into a car ownership, an aftermarket tire is more likely going to be better, unless it is a highly specialized vehicle like an M car, a Porsche, a GT3 product or something like that. There is one other caveat, which I've recently gone on top with. And again, AutoBuild did a very good thing on this, and I'm going to try and make a video on it later this year. The OE tire now, especially in Europe, I'm not so sure here, but because OEs, car manufacturers, are so incredibly focused on CO2 emissions, the OE tires are being pushed down the route to help reduce CO2 emissions. So that means ultra low rolling resistance. And one thing you give up with rolling resistance is wet grip. They're opposing qualities in a tire, so that's something you have to balance. Wet grip or tread depth, because if you reduce the tread depth of a tire, you get a better rolling resistance by default. So the magazine did a mini test at the time. They had a BMW 5 Series. They had an OE tire that was still being produced with that car that had been tuned for BMW for the 5 Series requirements. And that generally for that kind of vehicle, because it was just a generic 5 Series, it's rolling resistance, noise, and comfort. And what they found was the wet braking of that tire on a tire that's still being produced, a car that's still being produced and sold, was worse than a budget, like worse than one of the worst budget tires in the test. So even though it's a premium tire, and even though the tire pattern is a test winning tire, it's been tuned so heavily for the OEs, it's almost, you could almost call it a dangerous tire. And the magazine actually called it like the OE car manufacturers are so focused on CO2, they're actually putting people in a situation where they're having, dangerous is a strong word, but tires that are less than ideal, especially in wet situations. So then you've got the question like, okay, I've bought a brand new car, it's got an OE tire on that's been tuned for rolling resistance. I'd actually be a lot safer if I chuck them off straight away and put in an aftermarket tire, I don't think that's the situation the industry should be getting itself into. And it's certainly, once I've done a little bit more investigation, something I'm going to try and message out to the public and to the industry that you're saving a gram of CO2, but you're actually you're putting people in difficult situations.
Wow, I didn't consider that. That's, again, you're completely changing my perspective of tires, and hopefully the people listening will get a little bit of that as well.
That I got to follow up real quick.
Yeah, go ahead.
So for your 6 series, what kind of tires are you going to put on it?
The previous owner. So for E24, the previous owner put on, they're essentially brand new Continental Extreme Contact Sports, which is an ultra high performance summer tire. Because it's not a galvanized car, I don't plan on running it in the winter. I don't plan it seeing cold weather or snow. So I'll leave them on. If it was my car from you, I would probably try and stick with the original 13-inch wheels and TRXs because I just like the classic look on the 6 series.
Can you still find TRXs? Does anyone make them?
I believe Michelin is still putting them out every now and again. I'm really happy with the Continentals that are on there. I've got no desire to change them. He's got some wheels from, I think, an E36 5 series on there. So it's the wheels suit the car. They're not period, but they still suit the car.
Okay.
So I've got no issues changing that. My wife's SUV has Cross Climate 2s on in the winter. I use it as a winter tire, and then we've got some all trains, so Terrain Contact 80 from Continental on for the summer months, because we do a little bit of off-roading and camping and stuff like that. The question regarding OE tires and what would happen if I bought a new vehicle today, I don't know. It's so individual, case by case. It's a very, very difficult question to answer. As a generalization.
Well, before we move on, though, let me ask one more question, and I'm going to include a couple of visual aids for this because this happened to me later last year. Do you have any recommendations when it comes to age for somebody that, say, doesn't drive the vehicle very much, but maybe if the tires still have a decent amount of tread, but maybe they're 7 or 8 years old. Do you have any sort of recommendations on that? Back,
yeah.
Well, you're answering, I'm going to bring up some visual aids here.
So it's a question I get asked a lot, and I see a lot on, I'm a member of a few tire subreddits on Reddit, and there's a tire review subreddit as well. And it's a question that comes up a lot. That's probably aged out. The general, wow, what happened to that?
So for those not on YouTube, and you should go to Motor One Podcast on YouTube so you can look at the 17-inch Firestone Firehawk tire that was on my Mazda 6 last year that catastrophically blew as I was backing out of a space at Walmart. I was fortunately at 3 miles an hour when that happened, but all of a sudden I heard just a boom, and I thought I hit something. And a lady was next to me loading groceries into her car, and she jumped, and I stopped because I thought, okay, somebody just ran into me. And I looked in the mirror and I didn't see anybody, and I put the window down, and she was just like a shade of white. She was like, I think your tire just exploded. And that was the driver's side rear tire. And I mean, yeah, that's,
how old
the image you're seeing here? I was in the middle of the aisle. I spun around and pulled into another space, so I didn't hardly drive on it at all.
Should hope so.
It blew. I mean, it blew the bead.
Yeah, it's ripped the bead in half, which
I've never seen that before. And these tires were. Let's see. I had them installed on the car in 2014. So this was in 2021, and they were used when I got them. They were takeoffs that the tire store had. They looked brand new. They said that, you know, the person had them on their car and they just didn't like them, and they were takeoffs. So, I mean, I put maybe 35, 40,000 miles on the tires, but I've never seen a bead explode like that at low speed. Thank God I was at low speed.
Yeah, I mean, normally when tires fail as well, tires generally fail. When they're going to fail, it's because of heat. And when is heat? When you're driving quickly. If you're at the motorway at 75 miles an hour, that's when the apex and the bead and everything are taking the most stresses and generating the most heat. So, you're super lucky, because that would have been... That's not I've got a flat, I'll pull over. That's my car's spinning. What's going on? What just happened? To answer your question, 5 years is the industry recommendation. 5 years of use. If they've been in storage, like stored properly out of UV light for a couple of years, and then put on a car, you can go to 7 years sort of total age. After that, I don't think anyone would officially recommend it. There are tires out there for sure that are older, but you got to remember, like, tires are sensitive to UV. They're sensitive to heat and changes heat and cold, and they have a very tough life. They're running around on a hot, cold, medium, stony, smooth road like for years at a time, mm-hmm. and they definitely age out. So 5 years is my official recommendation, but you should be visually inspecting a tire at least every quarter just to check for imperfections, cracks, sure. anything in the tread. I know it's difficult, and I know everyone says, oh, you should check your tire pressures once a month when you're washing the car. I don't do it myself, so I don't actually expect anyone else to do it, but I definitely do run around and check tire pressures and just visually inspect the sidewalls and the apexes maybe every couple of months to make sure the pressures are correct, because that causes issues, mm-hmm. and just make sure there's nothing obvious sticking out or a bulge in the sidewall. But that's a very impressive blowout.
That, well, I mean, I even contacted Firestone on that, because I was like, okay, how does the bead blow apart? That's the strongest part of the tire. How does the bead blow apart? And I mean, yeah, I mean, it split right down to the bead, right up to the top of the tread. And these were older tires. I mean, you can see on the photos here, they're just a little weather checked. But I tell you what, Jonathan, I think about this every single time I get into a car now. That's how shocking it was. Cause if this was at speed, we're out of control.
Yeah. The other thing is probably worth mentioning, I guess you call them take-offs. We call them part ones. It's a bit of a minefield, because there was a study into them in Europe a few years ago now. And they found that they bought a load of part ones on the open market that are being sold in tire dealers and online and on eBay and things like that. And they found, I think it was about 20% of them had, on X-raying, they had structural issues. Hmm. So it might be that part ones, I'm not saying it was in this case, but it might be that a part one's taken off because the car's been written off. And the tire might look fine, but it might have rolled over a curb at sideways at 100 miles an hour. And it might have broken the bead inside. And you won't know that until come fitting time. But if it doesn't fail during fitting, if it's still strong enough to actually get on the rim, but you'll find out sooner or later. So part ones, takeoffs.
I'm not going to do takeoffs again.
Yeah, yeah. Well, people ask me, like, what's better, a budget tire or a takeoff? And I'm like, well, I don't know. Like, in theory, a premium tire with 6 mil, 5 mil, 4 mil is a better purchase than a budget tire at full tread depth. But unless you know the history of the tire, and the other argument people will give you is like, well, you're buying a part one tire every time you buy a car. You're buying four of them because you don't know the history of the tire. But you do know that the car either hasn't been crashed, or if it has been crashed, like it's been repaired and looked into. It's not just been taken off a wreck and put in a tire dealer. So,
And after this, this incident plus watching your videos, I didn't go down to this tire store and just get the cheap set of tires. I didn't get the top end. I did get a nice set of Toyos though to replace these with. That I found, it had some pretty good ratings. It had some decent ratings for wet traction. The car gets driven very, very infrequently, but that was quite an experience. So thanks very much for sharing that information. I thought you would get a kick out of seeing that. Cause I put it up on social. I contacted Firestone. I was like, Firestone, do you want to take a look at this tire that split the bead? And, they just came through with their kind of generic, email customer service. Well, okay. You know, let's talk about the warranty. It's like, no, these are way, way out of warranty. These tires are older, but
I'd like to know the actual age of the tire. Cause I don't know if you've got better pictures of the tire. There's a DOT code on every tire sidewall that tells you the week and year they were manufactured. So that would be able to tell you the age of the tire. If you've got that data.
I'm a nerd. And I'm a car nerd and I'm a camera nerd. So I suppose there's probably,
I probably
have a picture somewhere where I could zoom in and see it. I mean, I bought those in 2014 and they were takeoffs. And if I remember correctly, they were like a month or two old, according to the place that I bought the tires from. So if they were older, hard to say.
Yeah, supply chain is from manufacturing to being in a retailer new. Or even on a new car, you're talking 5 to 6 months usually anyway. So if they're telling you they're a month or two old as they were fitting them to your car, and their takeoffs, I would be inclined to not investigate further. Thank you.
So that's my prior experience, and don't go cheap, folks. Jonathan knows his stuff. You're at tirereviews.com and you're on YouTube, Tire Reviews, T-Y-R-E. Yep. You're gonna have to change that now that you're in Salt Lake City.
Well,
T-I-R-E now.
Well, someone owns the website and the YouTube channel. I have tire-reviews.com for US market. So it is it's got US specific pricing, and it promotes US specific tire patterns on that site.
Cool.
So that's
you've got it with a Y. That's your brand.
yeah, but I do have it with an I as well. I'm trying to roll out to what I just confusing.
Own it.
Well, let's transition to kind of the big question we got this week. And everyone out there, put on your tinfoil hats, because a frequent commenter and listener, Rui Rika, emailed us, and he's got kind of a conspiracy theory. I don't know that I entirely agree, but I think it's an interesting thought experiment. So we go.
And just a little background, this is relating to the Toyota GR Corolla.
Well, I'm going to read the email
that we were talking about. Go ahead and read the email, Bruce.
Yeah. So Rui writes, "Hi, hearing you talk about the Toyota GR Corolla, the Toyota GR Corolla could be an alternative to the void left by the canceled Subaru WRX STI got me thinking. Since nowadays, Toyota pretty much owns," he put that in quotes himself, "Subaru," "don't you think the WRX STI got axed so as not to clash with the GR Corolla? I really love the podcast with only the two of you, but can you try to get a car designer as a guest, preferably someone who is active and from an OEM, that can explain some of the things behind the current design trends, especially the always ghastly split headlights? Thank you as always. Keep rambling."
We need to get somebody from BMW on here, don't we?
I think a lot. The thing is, we can probably get a designer on. I believe Seth knows some folks. We can probably do that. It might be a few weeks, if not a few months. It's not
tricky thing. The tricky thing with that is making sure that the automaker is okay with them being on, that designers aren't sharing secrets. Yeah, we would love to have some designers on to talk automotive design. But we have some steps to work around with automakers. But
Rui, it's not going to be next week, but we can put the gears in motion and kind of maybe start making that happen. But anyway,
Jonathan, you're familiar with the GR Corolla, correct?
Loosely, yes. Yeah.
Give us a little bit of background on the GR Corolla. We're talking 300 horse hot hatch, all wheel drive.
Yep. So GR
Corolla, car that I want to buy.
Drift mode, I'm sure.
GR Yaris came out in Europe, I think, 18 months, 2 years ago, something like that, with this hot 1.6 liter three-cylinder turbocharged engine, six-speed manual, all-wheel drive, just kind of a rally car for the road. Americans wanted it, or at least a lot of American enthusiasts wanted it. Toyota ran a poll on Twitter asking people if they wanted it. And now we're getting the GR Corolla, which is the exact same powertrain. It's got a little bit more power, just like Smith was saying, 300 horsepower. I forget the torque rating off the top of my head, 270, 275, something like that.
Little 1.6 liter turbo three cylinder. I think it's going to sound so angry and mean.
Yep. Six-speed manual, all-wheel drive. And it's essentially a Toyota Corolla hatchback, which already exists in this market and other markets, just with this super hot powertrain thrown into it. And it looks fantastic. The whole package just sounds good. But Rui, he got out the tinfoil, made a little hat, and he is thinking, well, Toyota owns 20% of Subaru. That's basically enough to be a it's close to be a controlling interest. They also have a long history of collaborating together, especially if you look at the GR86 and the BRZ. If you look at the BZ4X and the Solterra, like Subaru and Toyota, they work closely together. And he's wondering, maybe,
Pure speculation here.
Could it be either Subaru knew what was going on and decided they shouldn't develop a WRX STI, or in Rui's words, did Toyota tell Subaru, hey, don't develop a WRX STI because we have this vehicle on the way?
And we don't want to compete with it. And it's interesting because we were kind of theorizing back and forth because we don't know yet what the GR Corolla is going to be priced at. And my theory was if they can keep it in the low to mid 30,000 range, Toyota has a really good chance, I think, of capturing Subaru fans who were waiting for an STI, are now disillusioned with Subaru because they're not going to get a new STI. It's close enough in price to where, okay, I could probably get a nice WRX for the same price of a base GR Corolla, which is still going to be fun. It's sort of the sweet spot. And this kind of this theory kind of adds to that a little bit. Well, maybe Toyota was saying, you know what, Subaru, you know, just kind of hold off on the STI for this generation because we don't want you competing with our GR Corolla.
Let's not rule out vice versa either, that they know enough about each other's plans that Subaru knew Toyota was going to make a hot version of the Corolla. And they're like,
oh, come on. The BZ4 Solterra Stormtrooper thing. They're the same car. Of course they know what's going on. Right.
Right. And the GR86 and the BRZ are the same car. But so maybe it's possible that Subaru just decided, hey, we have no need to compete in this market because our pals at Toyota are going to be there.
It's an interesting theory. Honestly, I would love to play this up just for the clicks, but it's not going to be the case. I think what Subaru said about just coming out with an STI for such a short period, the investment wasn't going to make sense. And we sort of maybe saw the next generation, i.e. current generation STI, at Tokyo, when they had their STIRA concept race car, they had a WRX all dressed up looking like the next STI. And then suddenly they kind of backtracked. So it's a great theory. I think it's probably not true, but the conspiracy part of me just loves the idea, right?
It's a very good looking car.
I agree.
From the rear, it looks a bit like a Mazda.
Is it first? Looks like a Mazda 3.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. I'm a little bit out of touch with Subaru. It was a brand that sadly fell off a cliff in Europe. It's a much more popular brand here.
Well, but it's still falling off a cliff here a little bit, I think, too.
It's stepping off a cliff. It hasn't fallen yet. It's got one foot over the cliff.
It's looking at the cliff going, that looks interesting. Yeah.
But back in my day when it was like the Richard Burns Impreza and things like that, the STIs were running about 300 horsepower. The non-STIs were about 240, I think, and the STIs were the STI is still 300 horsepower.
It's been 300 horsepower for several generations, yeah.
Yep.
Wow.
I'd have thought they'd have been 350, well, 400 now.
The previous, wasn't there a special edition STI?
Well, yeah, but they made
209. Yeah, just where they were getting up like 340 or so.
Yeah, but that was so limited edition to not quite. Yeah.
I'm surprised they didn't put more power in.
Well, I mean,
once Mitsubishi and the Evo Lancer went away, they had no reason to because they had nothing to compete against.
Right.
When those two cars were both on the market competing against each other, it was kind of tit for tat. And then Mitsubishi had its own issues and it had to cancel the Lancer and had to cancel the Lancer Evo. And so Subaru was just, it's the only thing out there. And they didn't, and I'm not trying to be mean Subaru here, they didn't have to try because they own that market.
And now here's a GR Corolla from a company that does have an investment in Subaru.
Yes.
There's a lot of convenience here. There's a lot of puzzle pieces that just kind of link in. And you know what? I wasn't going to get a new STI anyways, but I really, really want to get a Corolla. I really want to get a GR Corolla. So I guess maybe I'm okay. If the conspiracy theory is true, I guess maybe I'm okay with it. Don't send your hate mail, Subaru guys, to podcast@motorone.com. Don't send your hate mail to me about Subaru.
I mean, everything we've heard, it's got that GR4 all-wheel drive system. So you can have, what is it? A 60% front, 40% rear setup, 50-50, or 30% front, 70% rear, depending on what mode you put it in. So it's kind of the best of all worlds. Like if you're driving in the snow, you throw it in
It's going to be so much fun.
Yes, put it in either 50-50 or the one that's in the front. And if it's in the summer and you kind of want to roast some rear tires, you send that power to the back and have a ball, baby.
I've plenty of friends and colleagues in Europe that have driven them or owned them, and unanimously the Yaris, not the Corolla. Mm-hmm. But they all say it's a fantastic thing. I've yet
everything
to
we one. Hear too.
But yeah, it's meant to be an absolute hoot. It was super. I don't know if you hit it here, but it seemed to be super hyped initially. Like it was almost overhyped, and people seemed to get sick of it quite quickly. But there seems to be a bit of a mental resurgence as people are starting to pick them up again or pick up on them again. And this thing, apart from that rear shot, which is a little bit odd. Did I just see some forged carbon fiber? Lamborghini style.
They're going to have a circuit edition where the roof is forged carbon fiber. Yeah.
That is very cool.
The red one you're seeing here is the core, which is the base model. But then the white and the gray, let me find that shot.
Yeah, the circuit edition, it has the carbon forged roof.
Yeah,
it gets a big wing on the back. It gets a special hood. It's all appearance. All of the GR Corollas, they're going to have the same powertrain.
Except for that carbon fiber roof, that's going to save some weight.
Yeah.
But,
I mean, a little bit of weight. I don't think it'll make a significant difference, but
it looks damn good.
It's weight in the right area. Like it lowers your center of gravity, which is important.
Yeah, I mean, bravo Toyota for having the guts to bring this thing out at a time when it's like, you don't want to come out with another SUV?
Right. I mean, the hot hatch market in the U.S. is basically dead. It's the GTI, Golf R, put a slash in between those and this. And those are your American hot hatches, vehicles available in America, hot hatches. We'll get the Civic Type R in a couple months, but.
Integra.
Other than that. Nah.
I mean, it's going to be a Civic Si with a hatch, right?
Yeah. But it's not going to compete against this. The power is going to be down significantly.
Yeah, the power is going to be down. It's going to be front wheel drive only. That's what makes the GR Corolla such a hard fit. When we were doing up a comparison, we were talking. Okay, well. Veloster, it's like new Civic Type
R. I forgot about Veloster. You're right.
Yeah, but those are front wheel drive. Is somebody in this segment considering front wheel drive? Because I consider myself a prime buyer for the GR Corolla, and I'm not interested in Civic Type R or Veloster or anything with front wheel drive. If I want a car like this, I'm looking for the all wheel drive. So I'm thinking WRX, this car, or the Golf R. And the Golf R starts about $43,000.
Yep.
If Toyota prices this up close to $40,000, who's going to buy this when you can go buy the Golf R with a little bit more power?
You and I had the same discussion more luxury. Last week. Let's not bother our listeners.
Go watch and listen to that podcast because that was a really great conversation. Jonathan, what your thoughts here on the GR Corolla really quick before we move on here?
My thoughts are, I hope I get to drive it. I'm perhaps a little bit unlike you. I'm kind of car shopping for something like a GTI or a Civic Type R at the moment for tire testing, because I need something that's small front, not front wheel drive, but like good, like can accept a large range of wheels and has a good handling chassis.
Wait about 8 months and buy one of these.
Yeah. So I wouldn't write off, personally, I wouldn't write off a front wheel drive car against something like this. But it looks a lot of fun. I definitely can't afford a new car, so it probably won't be the car I get. But I hope it turns up. Well, this or the Yaris turns up in a test sometimes, because I've heard very, very good things, and it's a cool looking thing. And it'd be especially
it's very
cool. I'm in Salt Lake at the moment, so people love all wheel drive because they don't like fitting the right tires. So
very
cool. I think that would be a big selling point for areas like this.
Well, how
are
about
Subaru Outbacks a big deal there, like they are around here? Or
yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Okay,
yeah, and Crosstreks and things like that. There's a lot of Scoobies around here. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, how about we transition from something that looks very cool, and Bruce, I've got this ready to share. If you don't have it offhand here, how about we transition?
You go for it.
All right, I'll go ahead and drop this in. something that looks a little different. Let's take a look at the new BMW X7, the facelift.
It's
new for 2023, the refresh.
Right. Okay.
Yes. It's refreshed with its updated face. I'll be honest. I'll say it first. I'm watching Jonathan on the screen. I can almost hear the, oh boy. It's not as bad as I was thinking. And maybe because we've seen so many spy photos that it's kind of grown on me. Grown on me is a bad word. I wouldn't call this facelift attractive, but it's not as bad as I thought. Obviously, you want to go to MotorOne.com. This just debuted. As you're listening to this, this debuted a few days ago for us. It debuted an hour or so ago.
About 2 hours ago, yeah.
You can go read all about it. It's not just a facelift. There are some technological upgrades. It has the new iDrive 8 infotainment system, which makes this the first fuel internal combustion BMW to have that system. It was only in the in the electric cars before that. It's got that upgrade. The base model 3-liter six-cylinder is up a little bit on power. It's got 375 horsepower now. Of course, Alpina is now officially part of BMW. The Alpina XB7 is the range topper in this, and that'll do 180 miles an hour. Do you want to go 180 miles an hour in this?
Without getting a ticket, I can't. So it's kind of a moot point.
Well, imagine you have magically transported to the Nürburgring. Somebody hands you the keys to an Alpina XB7. Do you want to go 180?
Not really. Real quick, I want to unleash Jonathan on this. Yes, he owns a classic BMW, one of the most beautiful BMWs to come around in the last 30, 40 years. So I want Jonathan, real quick, though, we have been looking at these shots and debating them in our Slack chat for 2 or 3 days. So I have been looking at these photos off and on because people keep bringing them up. For some reason, it's starting to grow on me. Like, I don't love it. It's not attractive. But it's not as ugly as I thought the first time. So maybe it's not that bad. And now, Jonathan, I'm throwing over to you. This is your first chance to see it. So this is fresh to you.
Yep.
Go for it, man.
I actually had a conversation a few days ago because I saw we don't see much X7s in the UK, but I've seen a few on the interstates around here. I've just driven back from LA and came across a few X7s. And there's something about the American road, the color of your road, and the sunshine we get here, and the browns around that makes cars really pop. And I was like, that X7 looks so cool. Like, it just looks, it's not a car I would covet normally, but I even said to my wife, I was like, look at that. Look how cool X7s look. Like, it's something about them. Like, my first impressions when you showed the non-blue car, the silver car, I was like,
So that's the funny thing. I saw the one first, and then we saw the blue one, and the blue looks good.
Yeah,
that's the M50, the sportier version. Yeah. It looks better with some of the blacked out trim. If that was a black vehicle, I think it would look even better. But what we're actually talking about is disguising all of the stuff that I don't like.
So, disclaimer, I actually, when the new M3 and M4, the G80s were announced, I was one of the few people that liked the face on that, the big long grills. I don't like them on like the standard fours, like a shopping spec four series with the small wheels and no body trim. I think it looks pretty bad, but on the M cars, I think it looks nice. And I don't mind these grills. I'm struggling a little bit with the headlights. I'm not entirely sure why. It just seems a little bit unbalanced, but BMW have done worse. I mean, back Chris Bangle days of when the first 5 Series came out that was controversial with all of its curviness, the E60, and everyone slated it at first. And I was like, you know what? In a few years, everyone's going to love this car. And it rang true. I think everyone it was a grower rather than an initial love. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's certainly a statement car. It looks a bit like you've got a fireplace in the front in the silver. It just looks a bit sort of like old room fireplace grills, but yeah, I think it's cool. Yeah, I wouldn't buy one. I wouldn't own one, but I appreciate the people that do because it's a bit individual. It's a bit in your face, kind of cool. It's just big and ostentatious.
I mean, so, it is a bet, and those the split headlights.
That's what I was going to ask. Jonathan, where do you fall in the split headlight trend that is just becoming ubiquitous in the last, like, 3 years? Split headlights, it seems like every automaker is doing, especially every premium automaker. Like, that's what you do, split headlights. You have regular headlights, you have a piece of bodywork, and then you have your running lights.
It's like they've watched two... Yeah, it's like they've watched like Blade Runner or Iron Robot or something like that. And they're like, well, it's the future now, so we should be making futuristic cars. I'm sure they work very well. And it's going to be one of these things. In 5 years, we're going to look back at normal headlights and be like, oh, that looks so dated. But auto manufacturers keep on having to do this, don't they? They have to keep on making stuff look new and different. So the existing stuff looks old and you feel like you want to replace it. It's just that it's the cycle of consumption. One of my theories when BMW first announced the big long grills was, I'm like, well, if the future of cars is driverless and perhaps you own your car and it drives you somewhere, then drives itself and parks, and then you summon it to return, perhaps they're trying to make the front of these cars look so distinctive because that's the part of the car you're going to be seeing the most, because it's going to be driving towards you to pick you up. It's probably a crazy theory, but it certainly seems to be that, no, that auto manufacturers are trying to distinguish the front of their cars more and more. Mm-hmm. That's big, man.
It's big. And I mean, I don't think BMW had any trouble distinguishing the X7 prior to this facelift.
No, they're true. And the other thing that always worries me is these are the press photos. So these are what someone at BMW considers to be the very best combination.
Right.
And the blue one was okay. I'm struggling with the gray one. So to see an X7 with its basic spec, it's probably going to look a little bit odd.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up, though. I hadn't thought about the face of the vehicle being kind of the thing that defines it now, especially when you think about EVs, is that they have you do not need the same amount of cool air for an EV as you do for a combustion powered vehicle. So we're seeing these very different grille designs on EVs. And so, yeah, I wonder if designers are actually thinking about that let's create a very distinctive front end, distinctive, maybe not necessarily pretty, but just to like grab attention as soon as you see the front end of the vehicle.
Hmm. It looks like, if nothing else, it's going to be a very nice place to sit and drive.
Oh, sure.
It's going to be a lovely road trip car, that's for sure.
Oh, totally. I mean, all of the premium BMW, Mercedes, Audi, you know, Lexus, whatever, they've always been very nice to ride in, at least compared to their contemporaries. It's just sometimes the styling isn't there. You know, something I say is that you don't see the face when you're sitting behind the wheel. So
yeah.
It's kind of a moot point.
The M50 definitely looks better with the blacked out trim.
It does.
I mean, and that's really what we're talking about here, is really it's the blacked out trim. It definitely has a meaner look to it. My big problem with current BMW design language, it's trendy for everybody to hate the big grill. And I mean, I don't like really the big grill look on the M3 or the 4 Series. But what I really hate the most, they're just so overstyled right now. You get a little bit of it here on the X7. It's like, how many different angles do we have going on that front fascia? This actually isn't as bad like as the M3 or the M4, where those cars, it's just like, I think I counted one time, like, 9 or 10 different angles happening at one time. That's my big criticism there. I think the bigger grill could work. I don't want to see so much complexity. Honda was dealing with that to some degree with the previous generation Civic, and now they've come back, and now that it's really conservative to some people, you know, there's a good middle ground to be had somewhere in there. That's my big criticism of BMW's design language right now. Will this continue to grow on me in the years to come? Jonathan, you made a great point. It's like, well, you know, back in the Bengal era, everybody hated them, and then a few years down the road, it's like, well, that's not so bad. Mm-hmm. Are we facing that right now with the X7? Possibly.
I like it in blue with the black. Yeah,
I agree.
As SUVs go.
Jonathan, you're our guest. We're kind of finishing up for the show tonight. We usually do like an hour and 15 minutes. So we got about 10 minutes left. So we can slow things down. I want to know, what drives are you hoping to do this summer? You're in Salt Lake City, like you said. So I think the weather there, if it's anything like here, it's still a touch chilly. It's not perfect yet, but say
it's snowing today.
That's more than chilly.
It could be worse. There's a blizzard happening about an hour and a half north of me right now.
Winter three, I think people are calling it.
Yeah.
So say a month from now, what drives are you hoping to do? You know, once the weather gets nice, you got your cool six series, you have a wife, like where are you hoping to go?
So one of the things I definitely is high up on the list is it's not a massive trip, but take the six series to the salt flats and get some cool photos of it on the salt flats. Cause I'm 2.5 hours away from the salt flats. Everything. I took a C8 there a couple of years ago and like you can't take a bad photo of a car there. So I'm hoping to get some really cool stuff with that. I've actually bought, a Porsche Cayenne, a 958. It was a 2011 958.
Okay.
So it's the Cayenne S, so it's the 4.8 V8. And I'm turning it into I'm definitely following a trend here, but I'm turning it into a bit of an overlander. So it's going to be lifted, massive 80 tires on. Yeah. Well, it's more, I kind of want to push more into all terrain and MT tire testing. And that just seemed like a good vehicle to do it. So they look cool. They drive nice. And I'm in the process of fixing it. Cause I bought a very cheap ones because I don't have any money and I'm trying to fix all the little niggles and problems before I start like lifting it and putting the wheels on and things like that. But I definitely want to get down to Moab this year and like maybe camp out in the basin and do some cool stuff like that. I've just come back from LA. We just did a driving trip to LA and back. And I was just chatting actually, I'd really love to hit Canada. I don't know much about it. All I know is I want to do some of the mountainous parts of Canada to really.
You're close. It's not that, you know, it's not trip, no, but it's not, you know, it's a weekend trip.
Yeah. So yeah, that's kind of what I've got in the front of my mind for this year, from based out of here. And then, any opportunity I get with work to do a bit of a trip as well is, I'd always take that. So I'm sure there's some stuff in Europe I'll be doing.
Well, when you get your Cayenne modified, please send us images and please come on the show. Sure. We would love to see that. That's definitely a trend right now. We had a reader, this was probably 6 months or so ago, he was in LA, but he modified a Cayenne to be an overlander and had, you know, the lifted suspension and a rooftop tent and all that sort of stuff.
I saw the article. Yeah.
So that's definitely a thing, is taking those, because they've kind of dipped down into the normal guy affordable territory, especially the normal one, or especially the early ones. Yeah. And so, yeah, modifying those is definitely a trend I've been seeing. So yeah,
and when you eventually sell them on sites like Bring a Trailer, they go for crazy money. Like you say, you can buy a 955 for $6,000-$7,000 quite easily now, a runner that's probably 150,000 miles, spend maybe $5,000-$6,000 jacking up, big wheels, big tires, make it look aggressive. Sure. You go sell it for $20,000 on Bring a Trailer. So there's some people doing it just to flip them while it's trendy, for sure. But I wanted to go down a 958 route because there's a lot less of them doing it. It is the story behind the car is fantastic. It came on incorrect size BMW run flat all season tires, like the air suspension leaks, some of the windows don't work, there's a coolant leak, there's a bearing shot, like it's a story car for sure, and it's a challenging car that I'm growing to hate, but hopefully at some point in the future I'll have everything as perfect as I want it to be.
Yeah, we would totally love to see it, wouldn't we, Smith?
I would love to see it. You're talking about all the little things that that you're starting to hate, and I'm just sitting here thinking, all of the cheap cars that I've done over the years. That actually sounds really nice compared to the cheap cars that I've had. But it's like those are the qualities at the same time that makes them endearing to some degree, right? Like. I
100% agree with you on things like the six series, because you can do a lot of the work yourself. Like it's not going to cost you $10,000 if it shoots a gearbox, something like a Cayenne. Yeah. If the gearbox is actually fine, but if you hear like a small niggling noise, you're like, oh, is that going to be very, because it's an expensive SUV designed by Porsche, developed by Porsche. So I might have not paid a lot of money for it compared to what the market is, but maintenance is still the same as it was when it was new. So I think that maybe is where the fear and the hate is coming from. It's not that it's going wrong, because I'm fine with cars going wrong. It's that when it goes wrong, an air suspension bag, if you buy Porsche, is nearly $1,000 just to replace one corner. So Luckily, there are some Chinese manufacturers that do them much cheaper. So I've got some
There's got to be a decent aftermarket just because of how many we're seeing that there's definitely a market there.
It's a common platform with the VW Touareg and the Audi Q7. Mm-hmm. So there is some transfer of parts as well. So they're starting to be an aftermarket scene.
Cool.
Yeah, well, I want to see it. I want to hear all about the adventure, all about the trip.
Totally.
We would love to share it all at motorone.com, where you can go and read our podcast articles that go up every Friday. Sorry, I'm trying to do the nice nifty segue into the closing stuff, and I totally got messed up there because I'm thinking that would be really cool to just have a big layout, you know, of this Cayenne like at Moab and all this stuff. So yeah, motorone.com. Our podcast articles go up there every Friday. You can always send us emails at podcast@motorone.com. You can always go over to our YouTube page, Motor One Podcast. Like, subscribe, follow, smash buttons, comments, everything that you need to do to help us grow the channel, because we are growing. The more we grow, the more crazy stuff we can do. We have some really like outlandish ideas. We have some cool
guests who are scheduled.
Some really aspirational guests that we're going to try to work on. So
we'll see where that goes.
We'll see where that goes. But the more you can help us out, the more we can do for you.
Yep. Jonathan, please promote all of your stuff. Like, take a minute here and tell everyone who's listening where they can find you.
All right. Tire Reviews on YouTube with a Y, all one word. TireReviews.com with a Y, or Tire Reviews with an I with a hyphen between our Tire and Reviews online. Gotcha. Instagram, Tire Reviews. If you really want to help out, go on TireReviews.com and leave a review of your tires, because that's what I really need people to do. Okay. Is to review their tires, because that helps me, it helps the website, it helps the industry, it helps consumers pick their tires. So I think that would be, if anyone wants to do anything positive for the world of tires, go and give an honest review, good or bad, of whatever tires are on your car on tirereviews.com.
Very cool. Of course, we're going to plug links into all of those spots in our YouTube description, also in our article that goes up at motorone.com. So if for some reason you're struggling to find TYRE REVIEW, did I spell it right? You know what I mean?
The Y
in there. Yeah. I'm right. I don't spell. If you have any trouble finding that, you can get the links in our video at YouTube and our article at Motor One. And Jonathan, it's a pleasure as always to talk tires with you. They truly are, I think, the most taken for granted item on a vehicle, hands down. People generally, not in the performance world, they generally just want the tire that's going to last the longest. They're not thinking about what the tire is actually supposed to do, and that's keep you safe, keep you gripping the road, keep you under control. The more reviews that you do, the more you can spread the word. We love to help spread the word as well.
Yep. And whenever that 6 Series, whenever you want to show that, whenever that Cayenne is done being modified, let's not make it over a year next time before you're back on. You're welcome on anytime. So
I appreciate
it. Let us know. Absolutely. And yeah. But beyond that, good afternoon, good evening, or good night. We appreciate everyone who's listening. We love having folks like Jonathan as guests, like always welcome. And it's been a fun show tonight. So good night, everybody. And bye-bye.
See you, everybody.